It will be very interesting how future presidents use Twitter. Of course, now we think of Trump-style use of Twitter as typical, but maybe other presidents will use it in a slightly different form. You know, we are really just at the beginning of it.
Welcome to Cambridge Forum in Harvard Square. Tonight we have a captivatingly attractive topic, storytelling and how it shaped the world. I'm Mary Stack, the director of Cambridge Forum, and tonight we are delighted to have as our speaker an expert raconteur himself, Professor Martin Puckner, who recently published The Written World. Martin Puckner has accomplished an amazingly tricky task in this latest book. He has surveyed about 4,000 years worth of stories and selected 16 foundational texts. Each of these, for some reason or other, exceeds the norm to become a reference point for an entire culture. Puckner explains that these texts answer very fundamental questions in the same way that our genes document our biological inheritance. Puckner likens these essential stories to cultural DNA. Martin Puckner is a professor of English and comparative literature at Harvard and editor of the Norton Anthology of World Literature. He's read an awful lot of stories. In addition to being chair of Harvard's new program in theater, dance, and media, he teaches an ex-online course to hundreds of thousands of students in 160 countries around the world. You're very optimistic, it seems, about the future of writing, and I wish I were too. I'm not. But I don't think you can equate texting with literature, can you really? I mean, the sort of level of the kind of diminution of word use, getting by with cool, awesome, exclamation, smiley face.
Okay, so the smiley faces is another thing that's returned. Non-phonetic writing, right? It's iconic writing. It's like cuneiforms. Interesting that that's really taken off again. Compression. I'm not saying the average text or the average tweet is great literature. But so one of the episodes from the book is what I think is the first great novel in world literature, which is The Tale of Genji, written at the court of Japan about 1,000 years ago, written by a lady-in-waiting, Murasaki Shikibu, a wonderful and moving story. She basically had to teach herself literature secretly, because as a woman, she didn't have access to literature, and then turned that knowledge, that self-acquired knowledge, and her position at court into the first great novel with very psychologically acute, describing in great detail that court society. And what's central in that picture, in that novel, is that this court society uses for everyday forms of communication these short waka poems. They're just two lines. And they're not necessarily great art. Some of them are great art, but they are just, that's the form of communication, and you send them back and forth, hundreds of such short poems / text messages were exchanged at court. And the form of interaction was very similar. It mattered how long you waited before you responded. There was a clear style that emerged in this communication. Certain things would be said, certain things would be unsaid. Anyway, again, when I squint, I see a society depicted in this first novel that uses a form of very quick text messages back and forth, basically to communicate and conduct everything from love affairs to politics. So this is not necessarily reason to be optimistic, I suppose, but I think it's just a reminder that compression and short vernacular forms of short written expressions can do double duty as communications and very ephemeral and nothing important about it, but also lead to a form of art. And I think there are some people who use Twitter and text messages who figure out that you can turn it into a particular style. And again, you know, these
Trump certainly has.
Well, it's interesting. Well, he has to some extent, of course, but it will be very interesting how future presidents use Twitter. Of course, now we think of Trump-style use of Twitter as the only possible one, and it may well turn out to be typical, but maybe other presidents will use it in a slightly different form. You know, we are really just at the beginning of it, and I think there are maybe possibilities he can't quite imagine.
Another question. Speaking the truth, you know, that the telling of a story, which is so important and integral to so many cultures, I've been very impressed by the resurrection of oral storytelling that's taking place with the moth and live situations where people are present to hear people's stories being told.
Yes.
It seems like we're hungering for that.
Yeah. I agree, and it's one of the things that surprised me about the process of researching and thinking about and writing this book. I imagined that the role of oral storytelling would be important, certainly in the beginning of the book at this moment of intersection, but what I didn't quite expect, but what turned out to be the case, that the importance of oral storytelling continued all the way to the very present. One example is the Epic of Sundjata, which is this great West African epic that commemorates the founding of a kingdom in Western Africa in the late Middle Ages and was transmitted orally for hundreds of years and written down in its current and the most important current form only in the late 20th century. So you realize that this transition that we may associate with Mesopotamia or with Greece of Homer is still happening all around us, and that oral storytelling and writing technologies are as intertwined as they were at the beginning, and it's not that the one is replacing the other at all. And these charismatic teachers who avoid writing altogether are, again, are another example of that. So you're absolutely right. And this is partially, again, of course, a story of maybe new technologies. So the Epic of Sundjata was actually not literally written down, it was recorded with a tape recorder in the 90s and then transcribed and turned into writing. And that turning an oral story into writing is a really interesting and very dramatic and difficult process. But so I agree. I think oral storytelling continues to evolve alongside writing in really fascinating ways, sometimes driven by these technologies, sometimes as reactions against it, because you realize something is being lost. Yeah.
If you'd like to come up to the microphone, we can take questions, please.
What do you think of Socrates' concern that external memory devices like Google constrain or limit our knowledge?
I mean,
he didn't put it that way, but I guess he asked that fundamental question. And also, what do you think of folk songs as sung by Bob Dylan as exquisite forms of literature.
Yeah, well, to start with the thank you for both questions and start with the second, I was very happy when the Nobel Prize Committee in its wisdom decided that Bob Dylan was literature, and I think that precisely because of that intersection of oral storytelling and singing and literature that we somehow thought we had left behind was put front and center even of the Swedish Academy, the body that that gives the Nobel Prize. About Socrates, I thought a lot about it. I don't have a simple answer because it's so paradoxical that the only reason why we even know about Socrates' arguments against writing is because his student Plato chose to write them down. So, you know, in some sense, even though I was throughout writing this book fascinated by oral storytelling and how it emerged and was intertwined, I nevertheless somehow always found myself, whether I wanted or not, taking the side of writing, including in this moment when Socrates, but also Jesus and the Buddha and Confucius, they refused to write, but even though I'd said that their students betrayed their teachers, and to some extent they did, I'm glad they did. You know, I'm glad they did, because otherwise we wouldn't be here debating it. So that would be one answer. that in the end, as valid as I find these questions, as valid as I find the idea of live teaching. I mean, this is what we're doing right now. You can look at it later on video, but there's something important that we are here all together in a room and interacting and asking questions. All of these things you can't really do of a text. So it, you know, you could say that what we are doing right now confirms Socrates' choice or preference for teaching and for live interaction rather than just for texts. But writing is powerful, as we just said in connection to the earlier question. And so it's difficult to give up on something that's so powerful, and I personally wouldn't want to do it.
How do you see today's contemporary writing? I mean, I think Dickens and Tolstoy and Joyce and all these great writers were chroniclers of the time, and they could tell us so much about a society. Looking at today, who are the writers that are equal to that? And Gore Vidal spoke about music being, the state of music could tell you about the state of a culture. And how can you tell about our culture now through arts and literature? Because when I look at universities, I don't think art and literature is a priority for many young people. It's law, it's criminal justice, and the arts are under great threat, I believe, in this country today.
They are, in many ways, it's true. Student enrollment, student interest in literature courses has definitely gone down, especially since the Great Recession. And we are all struggling, I think, to convey to this generation of students who grew up with you know, smartphones and apps, to convey to them the power and importance of literature. I mean, this is, in the end, I think the deepest motivation for my book. I didn't want to write a book that says, oh, the young people don't care about literature anymore, but I thought, you know, I just have to make literature look as enticing and important as I possibly can, and maybe that will convince someone, and in my teaching and including the online courses as well, but to what extent I will succeed with that, I don't know. So there is, of course, a real worry that especially these long, you mentioned Tolstoy and some of these Dickens, these great 19th century novelists who wrote long novels, how can we make that understandable to students? One way I tried to do it, is that actually many of these 19th century novelists, especially Dickens, wrote in serial form, in forms that is very similar to television series, because they were published week after week in newspapers, and only after they had run their course in this serial publication where they combined and collected in these typical Victorian triple-deckers and then sold as books, and then you could, I suppose, binge read them, which is what we now do with novels. While they were being published, you had to read them in installments. So there too is an older form of publication that is returning in different forms today. But it is a challenge, and I don't know that I have a good answer especially how this generation of students, how to convey to them the importance of literature. It's a challenge. But I think trying to explain a little bit the technological prehistory and that what they are doing on their iPhones, what they do when they read something on the internet, when they leave a book review on Amazon, when they post something on a blog, that is in some ways, well, it's not Tolstoy, coming back also to your question, it is a form of written communication that is part of the partially technological story that gave rise, for example, to the novel. Novel, a form, even though it precedes print, really is very much connected to the age of print. And there's a good question whether the novel, as we know it, will be the dominant genre of the electronic publication era in which we are entering. Maybe not. Each of these chapters in the story of literature is sort of dominated by one genre, and the one for the age of print is the novel. And I think that probably a new form of written storytelling will emerge that will be different from Tolstoy and Dickens, but what it will be and whether it will be any good, I don't know.
So I was curious, in your research, I heard about a lot of stories from the Middle East, I heard about Asia, I heard about Europe. I was curious about, in 4,000 years of storytelling, what other cultures you explored and what other parts of the world.
Yeah, one of the texts that I also like to talk about that I find fascinating is the Popol Vuh, the Mayan epic. One of the things that is great about it is that the Mayans developed the only confirmed independent writing culture in the world, because all the other writing cultures in from China to the Middle East are part of the Eurasian continent. And it's possible, we don't know whether they were independent inventions of writing. It is possible, but that the idea of writing as it emerged in Mesopotamia traveled to these other places. But we know that the Americas did not have contact with Eurasia for the couple of thousand years when writing first developed in Eurasia. So we know that writing was invented at least twice. And in the Americas, it's primarily the Mayans who developed the most elaborate form of writing. And it's almost like an experiment to see whether the same thing would happen over again that happened in Eurasia, and it did. So there's a scribal culture, there's a sacred text, the Popol Vuh, wonderful creation myth. So I love it because of that unique quality that it's the only completely independent writing tradition, and also because it's another of these great stories of survival of some of the texts. So something I didn't get to talk very much, because when the Spaniards came, they very quickly realized that the Mayan writing culture was a sort of center of resistance especially to conversion. So the Spaniards started to wipe out, to burn all the Mayan books, and Mayan scribes realized that in order to preserve the Popol Vuh, they needed to go underground. But they realized something else. They thought ahead, and they realized that the Mayan glyphs, their writing system, would also be wiped out and that no one would be able to read it anymore. So what they did is they transliterated the Popol Vuh into the writing system of the victors, namely the Latin alphabet. And that's what they did, and that's how they preserved the Popol Vuh. So that is just one other, there are many others, but that is another one that I care a lot about and that I think people don't quite recognize what a unique, independent, fascinating text that is.
Because it's so difficult to discern between what is history and what is fiction, whatever else, like certainly in the case of the Buddha and the Bible, and then that times 4,000 years, where do you even start to look for the seams to try and develop a unified understanding of our literary and cultural history?
Because of the difficulty of this distinguishing between fact and fiction, you're saying? Well, it's interesting that distinction, fact and fiction, and that certain kinds of literature is fiction and other kinds of literature is what we now call nonfiction. That's a very recent distinction. Especially in the ancient world and beyond it, no one asked whether the Epic of Gilgamesh is fact or fiction. It was a story that a whole culture was built on and that became an important sort of guiding principle beyond the question of whether it was factual, the question whether it's fact or fiction, whether there was once a king called Gilgamesh who really rebuilt the wall of Uruk, wasn't really what was most important about this text. And that, there are huge divisions about how to interpret religious texts, sacred scripture, but I think it's always a question of how we read texts, and there are different practices, obviously, of how to read different kinds of texts. So I'm not sure I fully am answering your question, but what is interesting, if you take sort of this long view of literature and written stories, that this fact-fiction distinction happens quite late. And I think for me, what was interesting is actually to break out of that to some extent and really focus on written stories, no matter whether these written stories were what we would expect today to find in a fiction bookshelf in a bookstore down at the Harvard bookstore, or in the shelf for religious texts or political texts. I have a chapter on the Declaration of Independence, which is another text that tells a story and becomes really a foundational text for an entire culture. So this is the story, the written storytelling dynamic I'm after. The fact fiction one is part of that story, but a relatively late one, which doesn't mean that it's not important. And certainly I, as someone who was telling the story of literature, my book is what we might call nonfiction book, even though it contains a lot of stories. So it is an important distinction today, but it's a relatively recent one.
It's interesting to me that in the moment we seem to be in a kind of explosion of writing of all kinds.
Right.
It's true that your basic texting of two high school kids who say, sup, and eating pizza, ha, ha, ha. I mean, that may be anything from irritating to boring to, yet I've been astounded in my years of teaching at how the love of writing, of wanting to write, rather than speak face to face, we put a judgment on that that's negative. And yet, kids want to write. They want to write to each other. They'll write to each other if they're in the same room. Right. And so that seems to me to be, I'm not saying it's correlative, it occurs together with an explosion of writing, and I'm not saying there's a causal relationship.
Yeah.
But it is interesting, that, for instance, that a huge number of new writers are writing their memoirs. People want to tell their stories.
Right.
Right. And they tell them in everything from a loose prose poem to a carefully structured novel.
Right.
I was brought up on writing as a craft, on Flaubert and Elizabeth Bishop, and all these people who worked language carefully and for a long time before they would make it public. And yet, I am interested that that narrows down the number of people who have access to writing their stories.
Right. Yeah.
And so there is a kind of democratization going on, and I feel it's too early to judge it.
Mm-hmm.
I understand your reservations. Believe me, I taught freshman writing. I do understand. but I think it's too early to really understand what the future of emailing will be, what the future of texting will be.
I feel like that question was more for you.
You raised a point about emailing. You were concerned about it in the book. You said that the technology might not endure.
Well, I think it's already incredibly outdated. I mean, none of the young people would use. I mean, emailing is becoming as archaic as writing a letter by hand almost. I mean, I'm exaggerating a little bit, but I think, I mean, you know, the obsolescence of these different. I mean, it's happening so fast. And the point about obsolescence is actually a really important one that has to do with storing and preserving stories. I write quite a bit about different kinds of libraries and how they were destroyed and how texts survived or barely survived and didn't survive. And it's a huge, so we think, of course, today the cost of storage is nearing zero, that we live in we have the extreme luxury of being able to preserve everything at very low cost. But that's not quite true because of technological change, that actually the formats are changing so much that librarians say the best way to make sure that something endures is actually to print it out on paper. Because we don't know whether the old formats will be, you know, readable. And we can, within all our lifetime, this has already happened. So the questions of obsolescence, in this case, not so much forms of writing, but just really memory devices, is a big one. So we haven't really solved the question of preservation. It's a really live issue and of concern. Though, you know, I'm spending the year at the New York Public Library. They now talk about how when they get the estate of writers, they print out emails, and that becomes part of the literary record, of course.
As you look back on 4,000 years and try to make sense of the history of literature, but what about what was lost? why do some things survive and others not? And when we have a gigantic archive of printed out emails saying, you know, thanks for dinner, will we not lose things the way we lost cuneiform tablets that turned into bricks somehow?
Right. Yeah. No, thank you for this question. And it is a, it was one that was on my mind a lot as I was writing the book. If there's one lesson I took away from this history, is that really the only way to guarantee the survival of a text is to make it matter to each generation. What we don't use, we tend to lose. And really most of the texts that made it to our present from the ancient world are texts that, like the Bible, that were used in different ways and in different forms, but continuously by someone. Because a culture, we need to, even today, we need to invest attention and capital into the preservation of a text. It takes attention, and the only way to do it is to make it matter to each generation. There are a few examples of texts that are completely lost and that get rediscovered, and the Epic of Gilgamesh is an example. I talk about some of the libraries that get burned down, like the Library of Alexandria, and we lost so much literature through that. And it looked like that was going to happen also with the library of the Assyrian king Ashurbanipal, who collected the tablets on which the Epic of Gilgamesh was written. The library burned down. But fortunately, the Epic of Gilgamesh, as you also mentioned, was written on clay. And as we all know, when clay gets burned, it does not burn up, it gets hardened. It's like it was burned in a kiln. And this is why these hardened clay tablets buried under rubble, were able to survive for 2,000 years. And we didn't even know that the Epic of Gilgamesh existed because it was never transliterated into the newer, mostly alphabetic writing systems. So, and it was rediscovered. So there are some stories of rediscovery, and we don't know how many else there will be. So we may well rediscover other texts like the Epic of Gilgamesh or the Popol Vuh. But for the most part, it is, as you say, a story of a loss, and we lost so much. We preserve mostly what we use. And, you know, even today, libraries are throwing out books that don't get recalled and that don't show up on their records anymore. So the other thing is that you mentioned with the emails is that something might get lost because there's so much of it, right? And that, of course, is one of the challenges for us. And the solutions have then more to do with search algorithms, right? That's how we make our ways through huge amounts of writing, but also education and other forms of filters. We need filters. And of course, we are getting quite good at filtering. Whether it's the right forms of filtering is another way. So there's a preservation and keeping things from disappearing altogether, and then there's the question of keeping what's important in a sea of writing that's increasing at a frantic speed. That, I think, is the main challenge for us. Yeah.
Thank you very much, Professor Footman. You have been listening to How Storytelling Shaped the World, a Cambridge Forum event being recorded live in Harvard Square with Martin Puchner. We are co-sponsored by the Lowell Institute, the Mass Cultural Council, and Friends of the Cambridge Forum. Thanks for joining us, and please come again.